I was new to casting. Heck, I was new to removing my pajamas during the workday and leaving the house. Up until the pilot of Grey's Anatomy, I'd been a movie writer working at home. It was all new to me. And I was so darn happy to be in shiny TV world, wide-eyed and corn-fed and bubbly about it all. Everyone was showing me the ropes, and I was just along for the ride. There was a moment in the Grey's casting process before we'd even laid eyes on Sandra Oh, when everyone was pushing me to cast some actor as Christina, whom they all thought was great. I honestly can't remember who the actor was, but Betsy thought she was great. The studio thought she was great. Everyone thought she was great. And she was great. I, too, thought she was great. But I did not want to cast her. Now I know what I did not know then. At this level, everyone is a great actor. There are no bad actors. There are just actors who do not fit your vision. This actor was just not the key that fit the lock that turned the story in my brain. But at the time, I didn't know that was the problem. At the time, I just didn't want to cast her. Everyone was pushing. Betsy was pushing. The studio was pushing. I was dodging phone calls. I was saying vague things. I was telling people that I needed to think. These were the very early days, before we'd even shot a single frame of footage. I was incredibly excited, but the introvert in me was regretting being at the epicenter of a production. Everyone kept asking me what I wanted to do. In those early days, I was scared to have an opinion, because I was afraid of having a different opinion than everyone else. Betsy kept staring at me, bewildered. Who in the hell had replaced Shonda with a weird pod person? Because the Shonda she had known during the writing process had been enthusiastic and opinionated. Now I seemed to be fading. I kept my head down and avoided looking at her. One morning, Linda called me at home. I'd only known her a matter of weeks, and at this point, I'm fairly sure she thought I was a moron who did not know how to speak because I only mumbled to say things like, more cookies, I don't know, and I need to go write more, before escaping the room. Linda got me on the phone. Shonda, she said firmly, you are wasting time. You are wasting resources. Actors are being snapped up by other shows every other minute. We are to stand still because you will not say what you want. You and I both know you do not want to cast this actor. So you need to say so, so we can move on and cast someone you do want. This is your show, and if you cast someone you do not want, it will not be your show. You need to tell everyone no. We got everyone else on the phone. As everyone poured out their reasons for why this actor was going to be the perfect Christina, I could feel Linda breathing on the line. She was waiting for me to speak up. If I say no, they could decide I don't know what I'm doing and take this whole thing away from me, I worried. If I say no, they could just do what they want anyway. Finally, I blurted out, no. Silence. I had never asserted myself before. There was a pause. Betsy tried to reason with me. To her, I'm sure I sounded a bit crazy. I'd been so busy mumbling and being along for the ride that I'd never said a word. As far as she knew, I loved the actor. But Shonda, no, I do not want her. I do not want to write for her. No, no, no. There was a pause. Then I heard Betsy's voice rev up. Now I can tell you that energy comes from excitement. There is nothing Betsy loves more as a producer than someone who actually has a creative vision and isn't afraid to fight for it. Okay, she said. No on that chick. Okay. I could also feel her relief. Shonda had returned. I was just as relieved. That was my very first no at work. My first moment of asserting myself as the leader, the captain of what we all thought was going to be a tiny sailboat called Untitled Shonda Rhimes Pilot, but turned out to be a gigantic ocean liner called Grey's Anatomy. My first no. And my favorite no. Because of that no, I decided that I was steering the ship. And I started behaving that way. I started behaving like the thing in my brain was our only true north, and that we would be guided by it no matter what. Because of that no, Sandra Oh walked in the door the very next day. The lock in my brain found its key. Christina Yang was born. No is powerful. It's a big weapon to have in your arsenal. But it is a very tough weapon to deploy. Everyone knows how difficult it is to say no. It's one of the reasons why people seem to be comfortable asking you for favors they have no business asking you for. They know how hard it is to say no. Can you watch my kids for an hour? Can I wear your diamond earrings? Can I borrow your car? Or telling you to do things they have no business telling you to do. I'm going to need you to work my shift. I need you to loan me $100. Now, the answer to all of these should be no. Unless the person coming to me is one of my closest friends or a member of my immediate family. Frankly, if they aren't your closest friends or family, they have no business even asking the question. No, no, no. But it's hard to say no. Even though I've become a master at saying no at work, it's different in my personal life. Everything is different in your personal life. At work, I have the shield of speaking on behalf of what is best for the story, the show, the cast, the crew, the staff. Outside of work, I am speaking on behalf of what is best for me. And who am I? I am great at taking care of other people. So why am I so bad at taking care of myself? Why am I so unwilling to show myself the same kindness and consideration, to cut myself the same slack, to give myself the same protection and care that I would give anyone else? The problem did not change as I got more successful at work. It got worse. The year of yes continuously revealed new things to me as I shed layers of myself. When I got to this yes, this desire not to be a doormat, the yes to saying no, the television upfronts, the industry's yearly New York presentation of each network's new fall show to advertisers had just happened. I just stood on stage at Lincoln Center with Viola Davis at my side as ABC announced to the world that the most valuable piece of real estate and television was going to be mine. They were programming Thursday night with Shondaland shows, not just a piece of it, all of it. Grey's Anatomy at 8, Scandal at 9, and How to Get Away with Murder at 10. 13 years ago, when I told my agent Chris that I wanted to switch from writing movies to TV, I jokingly said, I want to take over the world through television. I jokingly said it a lot, to friends, to my sisters, to everyone. What's your goal? I want to take over the world through television. I said it jokingly, but I was not joking. I was never joking. And now it was happening. On stage at Lincoln Center with Viola Davis standing beside me, my dream was coming true. You know what happens when all of your dreams come true? Nothing. I realized a very simple truth, that success, fame, having all my dreams come true would not fix or improve me. It wasn't an instant potion for personal growth. Having all my dreams come true only seemed to magnify whatever qualities I already possessed. So my inability to be a shark, to pope someone, to fix, to handle, to say no, still powerfully in place at work on behalf of my shows and my people. In Shondaland, I truly was a gladiator. I was fearless. I battled with endless energy. But outside the office, on my own behalf, somehow I am back in the pantry again. Let me know if you need any canned goods. I was like a helpless baby lamb waiting to be slaughtered. A grown-ass television show running helpless baby lamb. The craziest thing about becoming successful is that all kinds of people decide that you are rich. And not just rich, they decide you are a bank. Now, the truth is nobody actually knows your situation. And the assumption that you have a ton of money is just that, an assumption. And not always a true one. If I were truly rich, I mean actually money for several generations wealthy, I would be in Vermont, making jam and writing novels, while my muscular handyman boyfriend, who would be named Fitz or Derek or Jake or Burke, chopped wood and grilled dinner. You see I'm not in Vermont, right? You see I'm not making jam, and that the only Fitzes and Derek's are fictional? You see that because you are here hanging out with me. But others, they get those cartoon dollar signs inside their cartoon eyeballs. The moment I had a TV show on the air, people came out of the woodwork. People I knew, people I hadn't talked to in years, people I only vaguely knew, people who maybe knew someone who might have known my mom, people who were related to me by the thinnest of threads. jobs, places to stay, money, scripts to be read, a part in the show, audition opportunities, tuition, films to be financed, introduction to celebrities, investments in their companies, a meeting with the child of their friend, you name it, and I've been asked for it. At first, I couldn't believe it. I really couldn't. I also couldn't say no. I would try, and then I'd find myself nervously babbling some excuse and talking myself into a circle that somehow always ended in my saying yes. My mother would stare at me in disbelief, outraged on my behalf. Who called you and asked for what? Do we know these people? Give me their number and I will take care of this. A no conversation was a 5-brownie emergency. At the rate I was getting requests, I was going to need to be forklifted to a special facility in a very short time. Do not laugh. Being forklifted is not a joke. It's my dark place. But then, fortunately, as suddenly as the deluge of requests started coming in, they started to slow to a trickle. Years later, I learned my sister Sandy became an expert at stepping in and deflecting crazy requests for favors before I even knew of them. I have good sisters. Gordon, Zola, and Scotty told me they dealt with it as well. My parents got inundated. Everyone around me did. And they willingly acted as human shields, forcing back the herds of weirdos and audacious money seekers. But they couldn't force back the people I thought were friends, people I considered myself close to, people I was naive enough to date, the foxes in my hen house. Soon after the year of yes began, someone I know well and love a lot, I'm going to randomly call this person Laura, asked me to give her a large amount of money, a very large amount of money, more money than I would ever consider spending at one time. Laura just casually asked for the sum of money as if she was asking me for $5. I am from the Midwest. I will fight you if you try to tell me to buy a fancy cheese. Bulk cheese never hurt anybody. And so what if cheap toilet paper is scratchy? The scratchy is how you know you are clean. You see my point? I am not going to feel good parting with that kind of money. Gordon, Scott, and Zola and I have dinner. Say yes to saying no, they tell me. Nobody should be asking you for that kind of money. That is your money. You earned that money. You worked for that money. You don't owe it to anyone. I don't care if you were a zillionaire. You are not obligated to give anyone a dime of your money. No is a complete sentence, Sandy lectures me. You say no and you say goodbye. You don't owe anyone an explanation. No is a complete sentence. I've heard that cliche over and over. So I decide to treat saying no in the same way I treat saying thank you. Say no, and then don't say anything else. I come up with 3 different clear ways of saying no. I am going to be unable to do that. Zola gives me, that is not going to work for me. And then there's simply, no. I write the lines down on a post-it. Then I slap the post-it on the front of my computer monitor so that it sticks out from the side like a flag. I stare at it as I get on the phone with Laura. Laura, a person I have considered a friend for years. My hands are shaking. My mind goes blank. I have to stare at the script on the post-it in order to say the words. About the money, I say softly. I am going to be unable to do that. The rant sent in my direction because I will not hand over my money is stunning. As I listen, and I do sit and listen, I feel a tremendous sense of relief wash over me. And in that moment, I am set free. The reason I've been so afraid to say no is clear. I worried, what if she gets angry? What if she doesn't want to be friends anymore? What if she yells and things turn ugly? Now, it's happening. And all I can think is, good. Now I know. The worst thing that could happen is happening, and so what? It isn't so awful. I'm happier knowing what kind of person this really is than I was not knowing. Saying no, what I really wanted to say, allowed Laura to reveal herself by getting her to say what she really wanted to say. And what she wanted to say was she was using me for what I could do for her. That she resented me. That I was her ATM machine. And you know what I say to that? Aw, hell no. Laura pauses in her rant. This, I think, is the part where I'm supposed to apologize and offer to give her the money. Later, Zola will tell me that while I may not see it, 6 months earlier, I would have apologized and handed over the money to avoid any and all drama, pain, and conflict. Zola will gently imply that I used to be a doormat. But right now, I can hear my old friend Laura breathing on the phone, and I calmly fill the silence. This isn't going to work for me. No. Bye. Bye, Felicia. And I hang up. I literally run around the room. I do that sometimes. When I get overly excited, I run around the room. I did it during the red wedding scene of Game of Thrones. I did it when they picked up the pilot for Grey's Anatomy to series. I did it the moment I got the call Harper was about to be born. I feel fantastic. I am on a high for days. I tell the story to anyone who will listen. People keep trying to comfort me over the loss of a friend, but they don't get it. I did not lose a friend. I gained a second superpower. I can make stuff up, and I can say no. Wait, I can do more than say no. I can say anything. I can make stuff up, and I can say anything. I can say anything to anyone. Any difficult conversation, any tough issue I have sitting in the pit of my stomach, any unsaid confessions, any itchy little resentment and unpleasant business, I can talk about it. I want to talk about it. Because no matter how hard a conversation is, I know that on the other side of that difficult conversation lies peace, knowledge, an answer is delivered, character is revealed, truces are formed, misunderstandings are resolved. Freedom lies across the field of the difficult conversation. And the more difficult the conversation, the greater the freedom. When someone says something petty or nasty, one of those little passive-aggressive things that would usually just pick at me for days, my new response is not to shut the door and bitch to anyone who will listen. Now, the moment they say it, "What did you mean by that?" I ask in a calm voice. It startles them. I realize that most of us aren't used to being spoken to. We're used to being spoken about. We're used to avoiding all the conflict. And of course, in the avoidance, all we're doing is creating more drama. A good friend was the queen of mumbling under her breath. Well, too bad for you, she'd mumble when I told her about something minor that had made for a difficult day at work. "What did you mean by that?" She looked up. "What?" "Well, too bad for you, that's what you said. What did you mean by that?" She was mortified. She hadn't been aware that anyone else could hear her mumblings. She didn't know that her inner monologue of bitterness was audible to the world. Her apology was sincere. The work she has to do on herself is her own. When something wasn't going well, when there was a conflict or someone was upset or being difficult, the more introverted me would flee and hope it all went away. The new me wades right into the deep end and asks, "What's wrong?" It has been unexpectedly glorious so far. Simply being willing to have the conversations acted as sort of a magical spell. Some potion was tossed into the ether of the universe. Because the moment I said yes to the challenge, the moment I was open to having the conversations, suddenly in that instant my life was changed. I grew more courageous. I shed some shyness, some awkwardness, some social fear. Each time I said yes, I gained new friends and new experiences and found myself getting involved with projects that I never dreamed I would be a part of. I laughed more. I was bolder. I was brazen. I spoke my mind and spoke it loud. And as busy as I was, I felt like I had more free time than ever. I realized I'd been wasting a huge amount of time and energy on complaining and feeling sorry for myself, being dark and twisty me. Now, I wasn't interested in being that person. Not when it was so much easier to just open my mouth and talk. I've become kind of obsessed with difficult conversations. Mostly because of how calm life is when you are willing to have them. Also because of how much easier it is not to eat the cake when I'm not stressed out or holding a grudge or full of hurt feelings. I stuck a post-it on my bathroom mirror that says, "I can say it or I can eat it." As corny as it sounds, it's true. I wish I'd learned to say yes 25 years ago. Between dieting and never saying what I thought, I wasted a lot of time. But I was making up for it. The yeses were adding up. The swagger, the play, the thank yous, the difficult conversations, the weight loss. I was beginning to seem like a different person. Over one of our weekly dinners, my three closest friends informed me of this. "You don't look the same, act the same, or even feel like the same person," Zola told me. Scott and Gordon agreed. "You are strutting," Scott said. "You glow now." "You used to be all slumped over," Gordon said, "depressed, and don't look at me." "That girl is gone." "Gone, girl." Saying what you think and wading into the deep end don't always have a happy ending. Difficult conversations are something of a gamble, and you have to be willing to be okay with the outcome. And you have to know going in where you draw the line. You have to know when in the conversation you are going to say no. You have to know when you are going to say, "That doesn't work for me." You have to know when to say, "I'm done." You have to know when to say, "This isn't worth it. You aren't worth it." The more I said what I thought, the more I was willing to dive into the difficult conversations, the more I was willing to say yes to me, the less I was willing to allow people in my life who left me emptier and unhappier and more insecure than before I saw them. My friend who asked for all the money isn't the last person I walked away from during this year of yes. No, that friend was not. No. Chapter 12. Yes to People. When Chris number one told me I was going to be presented with the Ally for Equality Award by the Human Rights Campaign, I was immediately more worried about my dress than I was about my speech. Giving speeches didn't even give me a twinge these days. I cared about what I was going to say, of course, but I was no longer afraid to say it. I was rounding the corner into what felt like the final lap of my yes run. It was starting to feel simple. I had the hang of it, this yes thing. I owned it. I was smug and self-righteous about it. Oh, arrogance. There you are. I just felt like I had the whole thing under control. I was running like a gazelle toward that finish line. And then, like any long race, that final lap got hard. I hit a wall. Turns out the beginning had been easy. The toughest part was yet to come. I was still struggling with how to speak up for myself, how to stand up for myself, how to gladiate for myself. It was ironic. I knew a large part of the reason I was getting this award was because by portraying LGBTQ characters on TV, I was speaking up, standing up, gladiating for others. And I couldn't do it for myself. Shedding weight was one thing. Shedding people was quite another. I had just shed a friend, a close one. I had never felt more alone. I was fighting the desire to take to my bed with Doctor Who and a box of Thin Mints. I wanted a little veal practice. For the first time in a long, long time, I wanted to be numb. When it was time to try and gouge for the event, Dana stood over me as I curled up in a ball on my sofa. "I don't think I can do it. I'm sick. I'm dying." Dana didn't say anything, not a word. She stood there a moment, and then just when I began to wonder if Chris number one was now hosting How to Make Shonda Move Her Ass seminars, she turned away and began unpacking gowns, stunningly beautiful evening gowns. No need for a seminar. Turns out that is How to Make Shonda Move Her Ass. Later that week, the dress hangs on the closet door. Sandy stands at the foot of my bed. I'm trying to remember how veal practice works. I tell her I cannot go to this event. I feel too alone. She tells me that I will go. She tells me that she will go with me. And then she tells me to invite more people. Invite your people. Gather your people. "Alone," she snorts, and shakes her head at my foolishness, as if being alone was ever an option. The morning of the HRC gala, I write my speech. That evening, I feel vulnerable standing there on that stage. I feel like I've ripped a page from my diary and I'm reading it aloud. And yet, it is exactly what I want to say. I want to give everyone what Sandy gave me, The snort, the head shake. Gather your people. Here it is. You are not alone.
I have been a writer since before I could spell. I used to dictate stories into a tape recorder with my sister Sandy, and then I tried to get my mother to type them up. I was maybe 3. And when I learned to spell, writing opened worlds. Nothing else provides that singular hum in my brain, that special trip to the imagination. Writing was for me, it was like sitting down at a piano for the first time and realizing that I always knew how to play. Writing was my melody. Writing was who I was. Writing is me. I spent my school days writing in journals. I still have them. They're these little fabric-covered books, frayed and fading. They're boxed up in my attic, about 20 of them, I think. They're little books filled with hopes and dreams and stories and pain. Let me describe myself as a kid. I was highly intelligent, way too chubby, sensitive, nerdy, and painfully shy. I wore Coke bottle-thick glasses. I had 2 cornrow braids that traveled down the sides of my head in a way that was not pretty. And here's the kicker. I was often the only black girl in my class. I did not have friends. No one is meaner than a pack of human beings faced with someone who is different. I was very much alone, so I wrote. I created friends. I named them and I wrote about them in detail. I gave them stories and homes and families. I wrote about their parties and their dates and their friendships and their lives. And they were so real. You see, Shondaland, the imaginary land of Shonda, has existed since I was 11 years old. I built it in my mind as a place to hold my stories, a safe place, a space for my characters to exist, a space for me to exist, until I could get the hell out of being a teenager and run out into the world and be myself. Less isolated, less marginalized, less invisible in the eyes of my peers, until I could find my people in the real world. Now, I don't know if anyone has noticed, but I only ever write about one thing, being alone. The desire not to be alone, the attempts we make to find our person, to keep our person, to convince our person not to leave us alone, the joy of being with our person and thus no longer be alone, the devastation of being left alone, the need to hear the words, you are not alone. The fundamental human need for one person to hear another human being say to them, you are not alone. You are seen. I am with you. You are not alone. I get asked by a lot of reporters and tweeters why I am so invested in diversity. Why is it so important to have diversity on television? They ask, why is it so challenging? Why does Cyrus need to be gay? I really hate the word diversity. It suggests something other, as if something, it's something special, like, you know, it's rare, it's diversity. As if there's something unusual about telling stories about women or people of color or LGBT characters on TV. I have a different word. I call it normalizing. I make TV. I am making TV look like the world looks. Because women and people of color and LGBT people equal way more than 50% of our population, which means it ain't out of the ordinary. I am making the world of television look normal. So I am normalizing television. You should get to turn on your TV and see your tribe. And your tribe can be any kind of person, anyone you identify with, anyone who feels like you, who feels like home, who feels like truth. You should get to turn on your TV and see your tribe, see your people, someone out there like you existing, so that you know on your darkest day that when you run, metaphorically or physically run, somewhere, someone, there's someone to run to, that your tribe is waiting. You are not alone. The goal The goal is that everyone should get to turn on their TV and see someone who looks like them and loves like them. And just as important, everyone should turn on their TV and see someone who doesn't look like them and love like them. Because perhaps then they will learn from them, and perhaps then they will not isolate them and marginalize them and erase them. Perhaps then they will even come to recognize themselves in them, and perhaps they will even learn to love them. I think that when you turn on the television and you see love from anybody, with anyone, to anyone, real love, a service has been done for you. Your heart has somehow been expanded, your mind has somehow grown, your soul has been opened a little more, you've experienced something. The very idea that love exists, that it is possible, that one can have a person, you are not alone. Hate diminishes, love expands. I do a lot of talking in my writer's room about how images matter. The images you see on television matter. They tell you about the world. They tell you who you are, what the world is like. They shape you. We all know this. There have been studies. So if you never see a Cyrus being on TV ever, if you never see an older badass, take no prisoners, Republican, conservative, Rumsfeldian, gay, a man who loves his husband James so much, so deeply that it breaks our heart when we see him try to kill him, if you never see James trying to drag Cyrus into honesty in the 21st century, if you never see young Connor Walsh on How to Get Away with Murder getting to have the same kind of slutty dating life we've seen straight characters on TV have season after season after season, if you never see Erica Hahn exuberantly give what's known as the Leaves on Trees monologue, where she tells Callie that she's finally realized that she's a lesbian, if you never see Callie stare her father down and holler, my favorite line ever, you can't pray away the gay. If you never see a transgender character on TV have family and understanding and a Dr. Bailey to love and support her, if you never have any of those people on TV, what do you learn about your importance in the fabric of society? What do straight people learn? What do young people learn? Where does that leave them? Where does that leave any of us? I get letters and tweets from people coming up to me on the street telling me, like, so many incredible stories. You know, dads telling me that, you know, a dad came up to me and told me something he saw on Grey's gave him a way of understanding his child when he came out. And I get these teenagers, and I literally can't tell you it's one letter. All these teenagers, man, who tell me that they learned the language to talk to their parents about being gay or lesbian. There are this scores of teenage girls online who have found a community of peers and support because of the Cali-Arizona relationship. They call themselves Calzonas. I get story after story. Now, there were times in my youth when writing the stories in Shondaland quite literally saved my life. And now I get kids coming up to me and telling me it quite literally saves theirs. That is beyond humbling. And every single time, it comes down to one thing. You are not alone. Nobody should be alone. So I write. We're only on the edge of change. There's still so much more to be done. So I'm going to accept the award as encouragement and not accomplishment. I don't think the job is finished yet. I have a lot of lesbian and gay friends whose marriages I think I would like to see recognized in every single state in the country.
On June 26, 2015, the United States Supreme Court legalized same-sex marriage in all 50 states. High five, America. And so this part of my speech is now thankfully out of date.
There are still so many laws that need to be changed. I want to applaud the HRC for their work in fighting so hard for the equality and the end of discrimination of all kinds for the LGBT community. The work they're doing is tremendous. Writing is no different for me now than it was when I was talking to that tape recorder with my sister Sandy. Yes, it's on a larger landscape. Yes, it's Hall of Thursday night. Tired. Yes, I'm less shy, arguably less nerdy. Clearly better styled. The glasses have been replaced by contacts. I'm still often the only black girl in the room. Look around you. But here's the thing. I am no longer alone. The characters that lived inside my head are on the television screen, and they are not just my friends now, they are also everyone else's. Shondaland is open, and if I am doing my job right, there will be a person there for everyone. I also want to say how much I appreciate the kindness and support that I have received. A lot of people out there have been very quick to come to my defense in really wonderful ways, especially after I tweet angry. I mean, I'm very proud of what I said to the person who tweeted me the nasty comment about the gay scenes. I mean, I would say bah, Felicia, to anyone again and again and again. But sometimes I wish that I thought first and tweeted later, because think of what an even more awesome thing I could have said with a rewrite and some notes. But really, I am eternally grateful. And finally, I want to say that if you are a kid and you are out there and you are chubby and not so cute and nerdy and shy and invisible and in pain, whatever your race, whatever your gender, whatever your sexual orientation, I am standing here to say you are not alone. Your tribe of people, they are out there in the world waiting for you. I know this because mine are at that table right over there. Thank you.
Human Rights Campaign speech delivered March 14th, 2015, Los Angeles, California. Chapter 13. Yes to dancing it out with the right people. I'm sitting in the editing room at Prospect Studios with my editor, Joe Matasik. We're fighting over what song to use. This debate has raged on for weeks. It's the season 10 finale of Grey's Anatomy. The scene is iconic. Meredith and Christina are dancing it out in an on-call room for the very last time. The song that will play as we watch them dance has epic meaning for me and for fans who have watched these characters grow from interns to attendings, cautious young women to powerhouses. We have been with them for more than 200 episodes at this point, more than a decade of our lives and theirs. This is the very last time anyone will see Christina Yang on screen. The scene, the song, the edit, everything has to be right. When the scene was initially filmed, a fast, awesome hip-hop dance song was used to rev the actors up and give them energy. Now, in the editing room, there are opinions coming in from all sides. Everyone who is there during filming believes that anything other than a fast dance song is going to make Sandra and Ellen look bad dancing. I find this to be ridiculous. I don't believe either Sandra or Ellen has ever looked bad dancing in her life. It's not possible. Sandra has a rock star Cool Rhythm Nation thing happening, and Ellen's got bounce, somehow both luminous and everything gangsta at all times. But the two of them can shake it with such distinct individuality and yet still convey so much kinship and harmony is what inspired the entire concept of dancing it out in the first place. They've been doing it for 10 seasons. This ain't no trick of editing, people. These women can move. I was not there during filming. I am never there during filming, well, almost never, because I can't be in five places at once. This time I wasn't there because I was at my daughter's school. I missed the live performance, so I haven't been pre-influenced. And anyway, I don't care. I don't want a fast song. A fast song feels wrong. A fast song bugs me. A fast song is all... Joe wants to know why I don't like it. It's a reasonable question, except I can't answer it. I don't have a way of explaining why I don't like it. I don't know why. I just don't like it. It makes me prickly in my true northy creases. We argue, we debate, we fight. These are not useless exercises. I want my editors to fight with me. I like to be challenged. I like to be proven wrong. I am deeply suspicious of instant agreement. Instant agreement terrifies me. Joe has been working here in post-production for almost the entire lifetime of the show. He's gone from assistant editor to lead editor in his time here. He's been around the block. He knows how these editing debates go. He knows he has a shot at prevailing if he can get me to stare at the story from a different angle, a different perspective. If he can tilt the landscape just a little bit. So we battle it out. Once I said yes to difficult conversations, once I said yes to saying no, I made an interesting discovery. That discovery was, happy whole people are drawn to happy whole people. But nothing makes a toxic person more miserable and destructive than a happy whole person. Unhappy people do not like it when a fellow unhappy person becomes happy. I am absolutely sure that this is true because I used to be an unhappy person. And nothing was more frustrating than seeing a fellow bitter, jaded, toxic, dark and twisty friend find their way up into the sun. Like a vampire trying to save one of its own, you want to drag them back into the dark. And you truly think you are doing the right thing. I was clinging to the dark and twisty misery. It was what I knew, and I needed it. I needed it the same way I needed the fatness. It was easier than trying. Being dark and twisty gave me permission to not want anything more than the miserable status quo. To never hope. To never be optimistic. Dark and twisty takes up the time and space in my head. It's a hall pass. I don't have to do anything about my problems if I am busy complaining and feeling sorry for myself. Now, I was the one standing on the mountaintop with a clear, sunny view, and I could see there was no room for twisty up here. Before the year of yes, if you had asked me who my close friends were, I would have confidently rattled off a list of names of people I love, people I've known for years and years, the people for whom I would do anything. My people, my posse, my tribe, my Bonnies and my Clydes. My ride or die list. A ride or die list is no joke. I mean, I've never ridden or died, and I'm a middle-class girl who used to hang out in the pantry in the suburbs where the only Bonnie I had ever heard of was Bonnie Bell lip gloss, but you know. My ride or die list before the year of yes was very specific. Definite. I can say the names in my sleep. As I write this book about the year of yes, that ride or die list, what does it look like? It is the exact same list, the exact same names. No subtractions. It's just that not everyone on the list exists. Well, everyone exists. It's just that not all of them are real. For the last 11 years, there has been one name on my ride or die list who only exists inside the walls of Seattle Grace Mercy West Gray Sloan Memorial Hospital. I'm not insane. I know she isn't real. I just don't care. Christina Yang will always be one of my ride or dies. People think the substance of a TV show is the words I've put on the paper. It's not. The substance of a show is character, and for me, characters may begin with the words I put on paper, but they are flat, like empty balloons you pour out of a bag. The actor breathes the air into the words, and suddenly, what was flat is now fully three-dimensional and alive. More nuanced, funnier, or sadder, or more cruel, or more vulnerable. I wrote, and Sandra Oh breathed, and what floated up was Christina. Our Christina. The one Sandra and I made together. That is who Christina was. A piece of my soul and a piece of Sandra's soul wound around each other and placed on television. A human collaboration into imagination. This Christina that we made was a revelation. She was never silenced, never small, never too insecure to make good on her natural gifts. The Christina of our collective dreams is larger than life and sure of her genius, and is drawn by us while often afraid. Our Christina was able to overcome her fears through sheer strength of will. She made bold choices. She felt fearless even when she was terrified. It's no wonder I leaned into Christina, wrote her more eloquently, colored her more brightly, drew outside her lines, let her do and think and live in ways that voiced my dreams. She did not want to get married. She had a genius that she chased. She loved her work. I gave her a strident desire to not have children because while I adore children, I wanted to watch her fight that feminist battle and win. I wanted us to watch and admire a woman who did not want the things we have all been told we are supposed to want. I wanted us to befriend a woman who was busy throwing out the fairy tale and writing her own story. And with every portrait of her I finished, I allowed myself to pay a little less attention to my own fading gallery. I receded into the background, where I could safely stand in Christina's shadow, where I could tiptoe in the footprints Christina was imprinting alongside Meredith into the earth as they moved confidently across the landscape. Christina survived things in ways most characters wouldn't. She performed surgery with a gun pressed to her head, and she healed by catching a giant fish and holding it in her arms. During my darkest hours, my quietest, saddest moments, my loneliest times, writing Christina Yang fortified me. That gun to her head and that fish in her arms, I wrote those stories for a reason. Those stories made me believe that all things were possible. Those stories were proof that I could survive anything. And Sandra's playing those moments out, breathing life into those words, into Christina. Sandra's acting those words made my survival and resilience feel possible. Christina Yang was the walking validation of my dreams. As a nerdy, introverted writer with an eye twitch who could barely speak up for herself, let me tell you, dear friends, that was magic. And that kind of magic is crazy special. The times Christina and I had together were incredibly real to me. It sounds silly to say out loud, but it is true. I have spent more time with Meredith and Christina than many of my actual friends. Hours and hours in editing rooms, hours in writers' rooms, hours alone hovering over a script. When you watch TV, even by spending a full hour with Christina once a week, you were likely spending more time with her than you spent with most people in your life. That relationship was real. That track I laid, that train, it was real. That train was speeding down those tracks, always on time, always a great ride. But now, it is heading for its last stop. We've almost reached the end of Christina's line. Sandra Oh is leaving the show. Soon she'll be gone. And when she goes, Christina will go with her. I am going to miss Christina Yang. I do not mean Sandra Oh. Of course I'm going to miss Sandra. But I can see Sandra. I can talk to Sandra. I know where Sandra is. No. I mean that I am going to miss Christina Yang so much that my heart hurts. In the year of yes, this is one of the things that worries me the most. I'm not sure how I'm going to cope. Then something happens with one of the people on the ride or die list. Let's call her Pam. Pam is a friend who I would describe as a genuinely wonderful person. Strong and really funny, witty, kind, laid back, loyal, adventurous. But as I leap into this challenging year of yes and take tentative steps towards being happy, Pam becomes a wall of ice. I find myself in situations more and more often where Pam seems angrier and angrier at me. Her entire personality becomes more snide. There's a particularly ugly incident early on in the year of yes. Then a nasty argument happens months later. I spend a lot of time wondering if I've suddenly become overly sensitive or have somehow provoked this behavior. I find myself tentatively asking her about certain comments she makes or things she does that just feel plain mean to me. She runs from any conflict. I am left baffled as to how my kind, confident friend has devolved this way. I'm concerned. But when it happens again, dramatic and passive-aggressive, I'm too far into the yes life to put up with it. Now, all about throwing myself into difficult conversations, I confront her about what's going on. It does not go well. I do what I always do when I want to talk something out, when I want to be told the unvarnished truth. I call on my inner circle ride or dies, Zola, Gordon, and Scott. I know they'll tell me if I am at fault, if I've done something wrong that I am ignoring. We gather for dinner. I tell them everything. They are quiet, listening. I keep waiting for one of them to jump in, to start some truth-telling, to let me know what they think. But nothing. They're glancing at one another. There's a silent debate going on with their eyebrows. But I'm not included. What? I'm freaked out. The ride or dies never hold back. Tell me. Finally, one of them takes the plunge. We've been wondering when this would happen, when you would finally notice how Pam was treating you. What are they talking about? They tell me they have always been suspicious of Pam. To their eyes, Pam is not happy that I am happy. She's suffering because I have changed, they have noticed. I am no longer willing to be a doormat, so Pam has no function. They very gently tell me Pam has never been the person I thought she was. I have no words. Pam? Pam? I am stunned. I am horrified. I sit very still for a moment. I close my eyes, and I think about everything I actually know about Pam. Everything I have actually seen or heard Pam do over the years I have known her. I can think of no examples of strong or funny. She's always on edge, not laid back. I've seen her be petty and vicious and full of gossip. So loyal is not quite the word. But she was never like that for real, right? Right? I actually gasp out loud. Because this is the first time I begin to understand something. Those friends I created in my journals when I was 11 years old, the personalities and the backstories and the qualities I gave them, the stories I was spinning back then to create a world in which I had people, people who welcomed the chubby outsider with Coke bottle-thick glasses and unfortunate braids, the characters I created so I would have a tribe. I'm still doing it. Right now. I don't have any idea who Pam really is. Because every single quality that I have used in the past to describe her is just track I've laid. Campfire. I make stuff up for a living. I made Pam up. The role of Pam is being played by someone named Pam. I have spent years having a totally fulfilling, completely awesome friendship with a person who is only a stand-in for a figment of my imagination. I sit there, realizing I am in a friendship in reality that mattered so little, because I have created this friendship in my imagination that mattered so much to me. I don't even think I like the real Pam. I don't even think I know Pam. She was just an avatar, Scott says it. She was an avatar. Yeah. I am unsettled. I am even more unsettled when it happens with a second person on the list. Let's call him Ken. I could go into details on Ken, but second verse? Same as the first. That's the thing. There's no need to detail what happened with Ken because basically it's exactly the same story. The ride or dies find this topic fascinating. We can't stop talking about it. Have I been just rewriting people's personalities to be better than the actual people? Creating them to serve whatever purpose I needed, I gasp. Oh my God, have I been putting character on top of it as well as food? That night I can't sleep. I've been seeing what I want to see. And now, like with the food, now that I realize it, I no longer feel okay just slapping some storytelling over the reality of the people in my life. It's not that I no longer feel okay. I am no longer able to do it even if I wanted to. Now that I see it, I can't unsee it. Everything is crystal clear. I've been left with Santa's stupid elves again. And I do not like ill-fitting and antsy. I don't want them in my house. I feel sad. I'm grieving. I realize I'm not just losing Christina. I'm losing Pam and Ken. Three fictional friends are going. Now that I can see the Shonda behind the curtain, now that I can see the track that has been laid, I can no longer see my Pam and my Ken. I just see these people who look like them wandering around the planet. My Pam and my Ken are dead. Truly dead. I can't get them back. The loss is painful. At least I have a little more time with Christina. Sandra and I have a deeply personal, strangely intertwined, intimate, cold, close, distant, vibrant relationship. The only kind of relationship possible for two people as emotional as we are, as mentally curious as we are, and as creative as we are when we have spent 10 years together as two halves of one person. We are like family. I see her and it is like no time has passed. We cry together, we laugh together, we tell each other dark secrets. We sit in restaurants and whisper to each other in a language that can only be translated in the context of this uniquely shared experience. It has been profound. The fictional person Sandra and I made is beautiful and intimidating. Put Christina up against any real person and there is no contest. No one else stands a chance. It's unfair and awful and not at all a way to measure a real human being. And yet, who the hell cares? She is the goal. She is freedom. And that, of course, is why I created her. And I think why Sandra created her. For me, she was not just what I imagined. She was what I needed. I'm grateful to hear so many women tell me Christina was what they needed, too. I am not alone. I once told someone that Christina was one of my best friends. This person got a little upset. "Christina is America's best friend," she lectured. "You act like you have some kind of special thing." I nod patiently. Yes, I know she's America's best friend. But I'm the one who gets to write what our best friend says and decide what she does and where she goes. Wait, am I still in the pantry? I think so. I make stuff up for a living, yes. But really, I make stuff up for a living. To live. To keep going. My time with Christina somehow saved me. Christina Yang raised her sword and chopped off the heads of every demon in my path, making me feel safe, protecting me. She was my test run for how each demon could be slayed. She ran every course first. She tried every weapon first. She attempted every tricky maneuver first. She was an FOD. First, only, different. And I ran behind her, getting all of her second chances. She did that for me. I now know that the demons out there are some version of me. I am aware that I am the only one chasing me, running me down, nipping at my heels, trying to bite my head off. It's time to be a better friend to myself. I'm not worried about my demons, though. Christina's getting off the train, but she's leaving me her sword. I will chop the demon heads myself now. I'm not afraid. Christina Yang made me brave. Ride or die, I love a fictional character, and I don't care who knows it. She had been not only Meredith's person, but also my own. I laid this track. I made this stuff up for a living. Here comes the train. Let's dance it out. But first, we need to find a song. I can finally describe why the other music feels wrong. "I want it to soar," I say to Joe. "I want us to feel like when they are dancing, they are flying. I want the same wonder and joy they feel in surgery to be felt in this dance. I want to capture 10 years of extraordinary friendship, of true caring, of tribal warriors, of ride or dies. I want to capture the glory of Christina Yang and everything she means to herself and everything she means to Meredith and everything she means to us in one song, in one dance, in one scene." Joe sits quietly a long beat. Then he says, "In one song, in one dance, in one scene." I nod. Joe nods back. We sit silently for a really long time. We say it at almost the same time. Season one. And the music battle is over. No one wins. Everyone wins. We need to find a song from season one. And it has to be a song that captures the feelings of joy and newness of two interns just getting to know surgery and each other. The result is perfect. Tegan and Sarah's anthemic song, "Where Does the Good Go?" a song we played early on in season one, way back when we all thought we'd do a few episodes, have a little fun, and part ways. Now,